Good evening, everyone. We're all good?
Can I ask a question from last time?
Yes, of course.
Okay, I just wanted to ask a quick question on the timeline that you handed out last week. The Great Assembly, 424 BCE to 314 of the Common Era, and then Tanaim, which is what?
The Tanaim is the sages in the time of the Mishnah.
Okay, then it goes from 314 CE to 187, but that seems to go backward 127 years. Why does it say? Where it says Tanaim, 314 Common Era to 187 Common Era. But you go forward, but this goes back 127 years. So you go 314 to 187. 314 to 187 is going backward in time 127 years.
Yeah, that's a mistake. It's supposed to be minus 314. The Great Assembly, minus 4242 minus 314, and then minus 314 to 187.
All right, so it should be minus.
Yeah, it's supposed to be minus 314. All right, thank you. Thank you for the question. Hello, good evening, everyone. Good evening. Thank you for coming for the second one. I see here some new faces that I haven't seen in the last time. So, first of all, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. It's not so easy coming in the 7 p.m. in Shari Tefillah, right in the middle of the week. So thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it. If there anyone who doesn't have those timelines, it's really important, all right? And the important figures of the generation of the Tanaim. So, beautiful. So if someone doesn't have it, there's many, many copies.
Thank you.
Right, we just learned that.
Yeah, there is a typo. Exactly. Let's ignore the typo.
Oh, okay.
If I can have one of the spare source sheets. Thank you. I needed one as well. A little short introduction about myself again to those who I see for the first time. I'm Idan Rakovsky. I'm a new Avrech in Toronto. I came with my wife, Priel. Thank you, Joel. I came with my wife, Priel. It's recording, so that's good for you. I came with my wife, Priel, 2 months ago from Israel to Toronto to be Shlichim. Shlichim in the Kehillah, in the community. Shlichim in
S...
Thank you. Thank you. Shlichim in STC, in Shari Tefillah. During the weekdays, I'm an Avrech in Bet Midrash Zichron Dov, which is a Bet Midrash for the community, both the Orthodox, the Conservative, and the Reform communities in Toronto who want to come and engage and learn in Torah. And in Shabbatot, Bezrat Hashem, me and my wife are here. Some of you already know us. We haven't met yet. We're looking forward to meet you all. Last time, we spoke, and we discussed the basic introduction to the Oral Torah. This is a short brief. What we did last time was to discuss, first of all, what happened at Mount Sinai, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe Rabbeinu two Torah. First of all, he got the written Torah, and along with the written Torah, he received the oral one, which is the interpretation of the written Torah. Because why? There were examples of questions that we didn't know without the oral Torah. For example, we gave the Etrog from Sukkot. The Torah says, "Lekachtem lachem pri etz hadar." A fruit from a citron tree, but it can be a lemon, it can be an orange, it can be a grapefruit. But we know that because Moshe Kibel, Torah, and the interpretation of it, and we all know it's an etrog. We continued and we discussed what happened, the significant thing that happened when the destruction of the Second Temple. What happened in the destruction of the Second Temple? Who remembers?
We lost prophecy.
Thank you. Right. We lost prophecy. What happened? We lost prophecy. And then we became from a nation who, when we had a question, we could go to our prophet and ask him, can you ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, God, what does he say about what is good and what is bad? What is the halacha? What we should do? We became and we turned from a nation that has a direct connection to Hashem. We turned to a nation where we try and we need to practice our learning skills. And only then, the first time, where the term and the definition and the concept of a rabbi first appeared. We discussed what is the Mishnah, what happened that the Oral Torah is the Torah that is not, you're not allowed to write down, and why did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was in the last generation of the Tanaim, which are the sages in the period of the Mishnah, why did he say, you know what? I need to do this sin. I need to write down, to sit down and to write down the oral Torah, even though I know it's forbidden. Because he said, and he quoted, one of the most important sentences in Psukim from Tehillim, Et la'asot le'Hashem, heferu Torah. God, I'm sorry, I need now to sin and to do something that I'm not allowed to do in order that other people will remember the Torah and will know how to learn it. And now we're in the Talmud. What is the Talmud? What is it? I've got it right here. That's a book. It has a page which is really, really, really weird. And on the back of you can open this codex. You can see an example at the first page of, excuse me, at the back of the first page of how a page of Talmud really looks like. I know the colors. There's no colors on the real one. We'll get to the colors really, really soon.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Talmud and Mishnah, is it the same thing?
No. So Mishnah, that's a good question. We discussed it last week, so I'll do another recap about that. Mishnah is the halachot that were given from parents to their children during the generation, throughout the big creation of the world, all the way to the generation of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, where you can find on your timelines right somewhere. Here, this is the Mishnah. Thank you. Thank you, Joel. I like the the props stuff here. This is the Mishnah. Mishnah is just a summarize of all the different opinions that we have in Judaism. It has 6 different volumes, which covers the entire halachic world, from Shabbos to sacrifices to Pesach to weekly stuff to marriage laws to everything that you can think about in Judaism are summed up here in the Mishnah. Yes.
But aren't Mishnah and Talmud part of the oral Torah, or are they not part of the oral Torah because they're written down?
Right. That's a good question. What happened to the oral Torah the moment it was written down? First of all, it continued to be an oral Torah. Even though today, these days, when beginning back 2,000 years ago, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi decided to write down the oral Torah, it's still the oral Torah. That's how we call it. Right? It's not oral anymore.
Does it constitute a sin?
To what? To write down the oral Torah?
To have it written down as the Mishnah and Talmud?
No. Not anymore. Not anymore. The moment it's been written down, You cannot just destroy all the books that we have as Jews and get back to the generations before that. But
one last question.
Yes.
The oral Torah was not supposed to be written down because you didn't want anything to contradict the Torah, which is sacrosanct. Is that...
The reason why not writing the oral Torah is because the Kadosh Baruch Hu said don't write the oral Torah. We don't know why we're not allowed to write the oral Torah, why we were not allowed to write the oral Torah. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave maybe one of the reasons, because it makes sense, because the moment it was written down, that's the moment where a lot of conflicts and disputes and disagreements in Judaism began to rise and began to start. Because people said, wait, why did you write that one? I remember from my mother that I learned that you need, in order to make a kiddush, something else. And Bet Hillel, which are a huge Bet Midrash, and back then, in the after the destruction of the Second Temple, said, you know what? You know how you should light up the candles of Hanukkah? We gave this example last time. How should you light up the candles of Hanukkah? You start with 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, all the way to 7. But another Bet Midrash, another school, another academic place of learning Torah, of Bet Shammai, said, no, I remember something else. I know that we need to light out the candles of Hanukkah starting in 7, then 6, then 5, all the way to 1. The moment the oral Torah was written, that the moment we understood how many disagreements we have, we said, we're Jews, we disagree, right? 2 Jews, 3 opinions, that makes sense. But it comes into expression in the Mishnah, specifically because the Mishnah quotes all the different opinions. It doesn't necessarily say what is the bottom line of the halacha. It will say Bet Hillel say like that, Bet Shammai say like that. Sometimes they will say the halacha ke Bet Hillel. And halacha is like Bet Hillel, but not all the time. Yeah.
But again, was the initial reason not to write it down is because you didn't want something to physically contradict the Torah? It's sort of like in common law here.
I don't know. That's my answer.
Worse than slander because libel constitutes a permanent record.
I apologize. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But there are other opinions. I don't think we need to try to discuss why we're not allowed to read the Oral Torah, because just like other mitzvot and chukim and laws, halachic that we got from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is one thing that we don't understand. And I think just in terms of Musar, sometimes when we do things that we don't understand, this is like a total devotion to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If what?
If unclipped, Musar.
Okay.
So ma.
So what?
What is the English term?
For Musar. What's the English term for Musar?
Ethics.
Teaching, ethics. Musar is Musar. That's a teaching. That's an ethic learning.
So
yes?
I get an answer to my question.
About what? Whether the Mishnah is the Gemara?
Okay, so the Mishnah is the oral,
That was written down.
Written.
Exactly.
Okay.
And what is the Talmud?
What is
the Talmud? Beautiful. That's where we are now. So what is the Talmud? We didn't discuss it last time. We'll discuss it now. What is the Talmud? The Talmud is not the Mishnah.
Yeah. Okay.
First of all, we should understand that. No, really. People think that they can learn Mishnah from Talmud. And I'll tell you why. Basically, there is a slight of correction in their opinion because Talmud quotes the Mishnah everywhere. The Mishnah itself is quoted all around the Talmud. But two things I have to tell you about that. First of all, the Talmud is much, much later than the Mishnah. Historically, you can see in the timelines the Talmud was starting, and I'm talking about the Babylonian Talmud, not the Yerushalmi, not the Jerusalemic one. The Jerusalemic Talmud, we'll discuss it, but I'm talking now about the Babylonian one. The Babylonian Talmud was written. That's another. I think was it written? How was it written? Not in one time. It took like 300 years to finish the entire volume. So not everyone wrote at the same time. But in general, around 200 years after the Mishnah. So the people in the Talmud knew the Mishnah that we know today, and they had to write down the Talmud. Why? Because they had disagreements about the Mishnah. We know that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote down the Mishnah because there were a lot of disagreements in halacha, and he wanted to have the bottom line and to say, you know what, this is the halacha. Never forget it. But what happened to our 200 years after he wrote the Mishnah? There were a lot of disagreements about this Mishnah. Why did he write that? Why did he write something else? We know there is another source. I remember I did something else. Why is this opinion? Why not the other opinion? How should you observe Shabbat? How should you observe Kashrut? What is a kosher animal? What is not a kosher animal? Or how can you define it? A lot of stuff, Judaism is so big and so wide to fit in 6 volumes of books. Really, that's the first conclusion we can understand from the Mishnah. And that brings us back to the Talmud. What is the Talmud? The Talmud in a Wikipedia definition of what is Talmud? Talmud would be the academic discussions upon questions that rises from the Mishnah. Let's try to do the academic discussions upon questions that rise from the Mishnah. This is my definition, so this is my copyright. If I don't ask you, you can... Yes?
And one more time, the Mishnah is...
This is the Mishnah. Let's try to put it like that. That's good. Please ask him more and more again until we understand. That's exactly why we're here. This is the Mishnah. The Mishnah is where the halachot, only halachot. I'll give you an example from the Mishnah. Only halachot. Here are discussions, no halachot. That's the book of halacha. You want to know how to light up candles of Hanukkah? Open the Mishnah.
Are all 613 in there?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a very good question. I don't want to get into that.
That's not the mitzvah.
Exactly. But what's the difference between mitzvah and halacha?
Yeah,
exactly. 613, exactly, Rachel, thank you.
Yeah.
613 are mitzvot. That's a discussion. What's the difference between halacha and a mitzvah? It's another discussion. I don't want to get into that. That's much, much, but the number, 613, it's not, we all know that. I hope some of us know that. But not everyone agreed on this number. All right, there are a lot of discussions how many mitzvot there are. Someone counted it as less than that. Some counted it more than that. The Rambam has his count. The Sefer HaChinuch has his count. I know that all those names doesn't really necessarily tell you something, but the mitzvot, the discussion of mitzvot, it's dated much, much later. It's not in our period. We're talking now around, where is it, Joel? I guess the Amoraim.
Oh.
Okay, good. Tell us when is it?
From 187 through to 499.
All right, that's a long time ago. So, we said this is a discussion. If I have an halachic question, how to light up the candles of Hanukkah, I would not open the Talmud. I would open the Mishnah. So what is the Talmud? The Talmud is discussions. It's, think of a recording that was put in the yeshivot, the Batei Midrash, the academic places where they learned Torah in Babylon, in ancient Babylon, and we'll get to the map in a second that I made for you. And there was a recording there, and everything, all the discussions, that were held in the Bet Midrash within those halls are quoted in this. This is like a documentation of, how do you say that, right, in court. There's the one that sits down and writes everything. There's lawyers here, attorneys. What's, yeah. Yeah, whatever the name is in Hebrew. Okay, thank you. I won't remember that, I have to tell you, but thank you. So that's the Gemara. The Gemara or Talmud are both the same name, all right? I'll once refer to Gemara, to Talmud, that's fine. In English, you usually say Talmud, in Hebrew, Gemara, but you can refer to both. You can say Talmud in Hebrew, that's right, but it's much more, if you're going to a yeshiva and you say, let's open the Talmud, you say, let's open Gemara. It's much more yeshivic to say, but Talmud is right. Talmud is even ancient. It's more correct than saying Gemara.
Is it Gemara Aramaic?
Gemara is Aramaic, exactly.
And Talmud is Hebrew.
Exactly, and they're the same word. Gemara in Aramaic, which is the language that is written, we'll get to it in a minute, Gemara is to learn. The Gemara something in Hebrew now is to finish something. But back then in Aramaic, Gimel Mem Reish, those three letters, were the root of words that discusses about Lilmod. And the Gemara was written in Aramaic, not in Hebrew. We'll get that in a minute as well. So these are discussions that made up inside the yeshivot. The yeshivot inside the schools that they learn Torah there. For example, just how do we know there are discussions? Because one, Rabbi Yochanan sat in his Bet Midrash, like here, Rachel, he sat next to his table. On the other side, we have Barry, and he said, Rabbi Barry said right there. And Hugh said, Rachel, you said in Halacha. Barry used another halacha. You disagree? Your disagreement would be quoted for thousands of years after in this Talmud. Everything you're going to say, everything you thought about, the reason you said your opinions, why is that? What's standing behind your opinion? All of this and more is in the Gemara itself. So when you learn Gemara, and that's the first thing I want you to know, when you're going to learn Gemara, Bezrat Hashem, you're going to read discussions. You're not going to read stories. The stories you're going to read are in discussion. There are stories in the Gemara. But it's not like a story like you open a book. It's not like Harry Potter. You have like a plot. There's no plot in the Gemara. And that's not a list of halachot. If you want to know what to do halachically, you will never find your answer in the Gemara. If you want to know, how should you light up candles of Hanukkah? Or if you want to know, when exactly Shabbat starts, if it's right before the sunset, or a little bit after the sunset, or when exactly Shabbat starts, and you open the Gemara, you'll find like 12 different opinions of different rabbanim and rabbis. What do you think about this stuff? So what's so important in the Gemara? Why is it so important? And I have to tell you, this book, this is one volume out of 20-something, I don't remember now. This book is has more influence on our daily life than the five books of Moses, than the Torah. This book has more influence in our lives than the five books of Moses. Now you ask me how. How come? People wrote it, right? This is like, people wrote it. And this is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's the difference between this and this? How can you even compare? Of course this is a much, much important book. Right, this is more important. But practically, you cannot learn halachot from the Torah. When the Torah says again, I don't know, Shabbos, observe Shabbos. Okay, how can I do that? What is to observe Shabbos? What is permitted? What is not permitted during Shabbos? What about, I don't know, driving a car? Can I drive a car on Shabbos? If I'm going to look for answers in this book, I will never find them. Never. Because this is the written Torah. I will find my answers when I open the Mishnah, and I'll read the opinions, and afterwards, I'll open the Gemara, the Talmud, 1 second, and I'll read what the Gemara has to say about this. Oh, there are different opinions. One opinion say, you light up candles of Hanukkah 1 to 7. The other opinion say, you light up the candles of Hanukkah 7 to 1. The Gemara will ask about this, why? Why does the first rabbi say 1 to 7 and the other rabbi say 7 to 1? The Mishnah will never tell you why they say those stuff. The Mishnah will never tell you why they say their opinions. The Mishnah will say, he said that, they said that, good luck with that. But the generations after the Mishnah wanted to understand what exactly was standing behind the saying, the opinions of the generation that was before them. Why did one class say this and another class said another thing? This is why we have the Gemara. And without the Gemara, we would not understand most of the things that we do in our daily life. But there is one rule that we have to stick with it, and we have to understand. Every time the rabbi and the Gemara have questions on the generation that were before them, say so-called the Tanaim. Again, the generation of the Gemara is Amoraim. That's the name of it. The generation of the Mishnah is Tanaim. All right? Let's remember that. Amoraim and Tanaim. You can see it in your timelines. Amoraim is right after the Tanaim. Every time the Amoraim have a question that they want to ask and they want to rise on and upon the Mishnah, the Tanaim, they can ask it. But they will never, never contradict it. Never. Dignity is the first lesson we can learn from Talmud. The generation of the Talmud will say, you know what? I have respect to the rabbis before me. I have respect to the generations before me. I know what they said. I have question on it. But if I disagree, you know who's going to win? Them. I will never change what my previous generation has decided. This law in Hebrew is called Amoraim lo yachleku al Tanaim. The Amorites, the Amoraim, will never disagree. They will disagree. But eventually, what's going to be the halacha? What the Tanaim said. And they acknowledge it. They say it. There is an halacha that says, we brought it in last time source sheet, a Beit Din, a court, will never be able to change another court's psak, another court verdict, halachically verdict, only if it's bigger in terms of wisdom and numbers. But this is funny. How can you know that one court is bigger than other in wisdom? So the Gemara would say, the more previous you are, the more historically you are in our Jewish timeline, the more wise you are. This is one of the basic rules of Talmud Torah. Whenever you open something that someone said before you, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a Amoraim to Tanaim, it can be me to my rabbi. It can be my rabbi to his rabbi. It can be children to their fathers and mothers. It can be anyone else that learns something from someone who is older than him, who has more experience than him. You must pay respect to what he said, and you cannot just, you know, cancel and say, whatever you said, that's nonsense. That's, maybe it's not nonsense, but that's, you know, relevant only to your time. Our generation knows better. We know exactly how Shabbat's supposed to be. We know exactly how Kashrut's supposed to be. Whatever you say, it's nonsense. I'll decide. I know my generation better. This kind of opinions, this kind of statement, don't have room in Judaism. They don't have room in Judaism because Judaism has never been like that. And how do we know that? Because we have the Gemara. We have the Talmud. The Talmud, every time he disagrees with the Mishnah, he will say he disagrees. But they will get what the Mishnah say. There are exceptions. There are exceptions, all right? I'm not going to discuss it now because there are some things that's changed, all right? We don't live our lives like the rabbis from the Mishnah live. We don't, practically. How halacha changes, how it evolves, how certain things change through time, through, I don't know, today we have a Shabbat elevator. You know what Shabbat elevator is? It just lifts you up. How can you use Shabbat elevator if you're not allowed to use electricity on Shabbos? For example, a lot of other stuff, a lot of other questions that all the time rises up, they will always be, there is evolution to the halacha. Halacha evolves. But all the time, it has to be with dignity and respect and connected to what the last generation said. So let's dive into what we have here. How did the Jewish nation get to Babylon? What happened? We know that the Mishnah was written in Israel, in the land of Israel. We know it was after the destruction of the Second Temple. What happened? Why did the Jewish nation has moved from Israel all the way to Babylon, built an empire of Torah study, of enrichment, of a lot of settlements and cities, and only for Jews? What happened? Babylon was the biggest empire back then. We're talking about, again, from 187 to 499. All right? We're talking after. We're talking BC. All right? Not BCE. After the count. Look at your map here that I made. I hope it's fine. I tried to combine a regular map with the map that I drew. The name that you have in the circles are the name of the rabbis you will find in the Gemara, in the Talmud. Not all of them appear here, but the most of them, the most important ones, appear in those circles. All the dots that you have in the names are cities, names of cities and towns and settlements that were back then in Babylon. You can see that most of the settlements of the Jews were located right between two rivers, the Hiddekel River and the Prat River. Now, we already know the Chidekel River and the Prat River from when? From the story about Gan Eden, of the Garden of Eden. The Torah says that there are Nahal Yotzem Eden. There are rivers, four rivers that go out of Eden. One of them is the Chidekel, the other one is Prat. So we know that the Garden of Eden is not somewhere that is in another space. It's somewhere where Iraq is today. I don't know how Iraq is paradise. I'm not saying that Iraq is paradise, but we know the Garden of Eden were somewhere, physically, geographically, somewhere in this area. I want you to show, please pass it around. I printed here just for us to see a little bit how it looks today. There are pictures here that I found. First of all is of the city Mechoza. The city Mechoza, you can see it here on your map. On the brown one, Mechoza, where Rabba Barabua, Rav Yosef Barchama, Rava, Rav Acha Barchuna, Rav Meri, Marzut Rabben Meri, all those rabbis, we don't understand their names, but all those rabbis lived and walked and dwelled in this land, in this city of Mechoza. This city is still up today. It's still built up in Iraq. It's still called Mechoza. There are a lot of ancient archaeological things that were found there, and unfortunately, none of us are allowed to go there and to visit. Maybe one day we will. But I wanted to see that. And the other one is a picture of the Prat River and the Chidekel River. And the Gemara, which was written in Babylon, in those specific cities, every big city that you see here had a yeshiva there, had a school. A school for learning Torah. Pumbedita, Nahardea, and Sura were the biggest yeshivas, were the biggest cities. Pumbedita, Nahardea, and Sura. They were the biggest city with the strongest yeshiva. If you were, back then, the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, of Nahardea, of Pumbedita, you were someone that everyone knew. You're popular. Your name was famous throughout Babylon back then. If you lived in Kafri or Papunya, you're less known. Sometimes we know about stories about rabbis, Amoraim, that moved from one city to another city in order to grow up in Torah, to learn another Bet Midrash. We know about different traditions between, let's say, Matamachsia and Sura. You see Matamachsia here, which is a small city next to Sura. We know about stories about an Amora called Rav. That's his name, Rav. Like Rabbi Rav. Rav, all the time, he went from Sura to Matamachsia because Matamachsia did not have a big yeshiva. And they wanted a big rabbi to go there and to teach them Torah. So all the time, throughout the Talmud, there is stories from Rav who say, you know what? I remember once I went to Matamachsia. I remember a story that one of the farmers had told me. I remember something. And he learned from the simple, everyday people in Matamachsia, a lot of his halachot that we do all the time until today. Please pass it. You can see the pictures. You're welcome. You can see that Prat River is much more, beautiful, much more lifted the Garden of Eden than Chidekel. But Chidekel is today one of the biggest rivers in the entire area. I don't remember if Baghdad is on the coast of the river. I think it is. I don't remember, so don't call me on what I was going to say, but I think it is. So you can see that this entire place between those two rivers, Chidekel and Prat, was one of the biggest historical places where Jews prospered. They had the freedom from the Babylonian kingdom to sit, work, learn Torah. They had the freedom. No, the Babylonian kingdom back then were good with them. They gave them freedom in order to do that. We know that this kind of thing, that Jews go all the way to another land in order to prosper in life, happens other stuff. Oh, we now in Canada. We're not in Israel. So we know it happens. All right. So that thing, the Babylonian back there were the America of their times. All right. Pompedita was New York. Sura was Los Angeles. Maybe Shalchi was Toronto. Think about like that, really. People moved from Toronto to New York. They flew to L.A. New York is one of the biggest places where you can learn Torah, even after the state of Israel was established. You have the YU. You have other yeshivot. You have a lot of shuls, all the Jews in America, everything they did, it's like the circle of life. It everything, you know, comes back again. And like after hundreds of years, the Jews in Babylon were vanished. Something happened. We'll talk about what happened. Why did it continue? You know, the circle of life continues. And they went back to Israel. And let's hope the end of it, of this story, won't be like the end of the nowadays Babylon. So please keep it, that everyone has a copy. That's for you. You don't need to return me back. You can see it whenever you're going to open Talmud. You can take out the map. If you have a name that you can see, you see, let's say Shmuel, you know Shmuel is from Nehardea, and you can see where Nehardea is. It's on the Prat River. You have the picture of Prat River. That's good for you in order to understand everything about the people of the Gemara.
The Iraqis actually want the Jews to come back now.
The what?
The Iraqis. They want the Jews to come back to Iraq.
They want the Jews to come back.
Yesterday was a video circulated recently.
I would not want to. I would not want to go there. I don't know. All right. So, we said that there's two different Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and there is the Yerushalmi Talmud. The Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. What's the difference? Two things. First of all, at the same time when the Babylonian Talmud was formed, was established, at the very same time there were still Jews in Israel. There were still Rabbeim in Israel. More than that, we have a lot of stories between the Yerushalmi Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud of rabbis, especially in the first generations, were moving back and forth from Israel to Babylon in order to teach and learn Torah. Some of them grew up in Israel, they moved to Babylon, they went back to Israel to teach Torah, some of the Babylonians came to Israel. There was connection between Israel and Babylon. They knew each other. They knew both of them are writing the Yerushalmi Talmud. We know that, because there are quotations that appear here and appear there. But what happened? Why is the Babylonian Talmud the more famous one? The more that is people more learn? For a couple of reasons. First of all, the Babylonian Talmud is much more easy. Why is it more easy? Because first of all, Aramaic, the Babylonian Aramaic makes much more sense. The Yerushalmi Talmud is written in an Israeli Aramaic. Good luck with trying to read it. Really, good luck with that. It's really, really difficult. For years, and when I say for years, I mean for hundreds and thousands of years, people never opened the Yerushalmi. Never. Baruch Hashem, we have the Schottenstein edition, if you've heard of it. This is from the past 10 years. That the group of rabbis said, you know what, we're back in Israel, we need to learn the Israeli Talmud. Cannot wait to learn all the time the Talmud from the Galut. They tried to translate it into Hebrew, into modern Hebrew, into modern English. Now you can find more and more volumes of the Yerushalmi Talmud that is being translated, and now more and more yeshivot and places are starting to learn it. But it's not so popular. It's very complicated. Another reason why the Yerushalmi Talmud, the Israeli Talmud, is not so popular is because we don't have a lot of it. The Israeli Talmud did not survive history. We don't have a lot of copies of it. We don't have a lot of documentations from it because not everyone learned it. The Babylonian Talmud is a Talmud where my grandfather, my grandfather, and 1,000 years ago, they still learned the same pages and the same words we have today, and therefore, it continued. One of the biggest achievements that happened, that the Babylonian Talmud became very popular, was around 1600, where publication became to be more popular. People tried to publicate, right? The press. Became much more popular. People started, instead of writing in handwrite the Talmud, which is really, really long and difficult, they started to just print it and became much more publicized. People started to learn Talmud when they didn't even know it was existing. But the only thing that was printed was the Babylonian one. That's another reason why the Babylonian one was much more preserved, much more popular in ancient times. But yes, there is a big movement, mostly in Israel, that say, you know what, we need to come back to our roots. This Talmud was formed in Israel, in the Holy Land. Let's learn the Talmud of the Holy Land. We don't need to learn the Talmud of the Galut. But still, the Babylonian Talmud is much more popular, and we will focus on the Babylonian Talmud and not on the Yerushalmi one.
So what? Yes. Israel, I didn't know there were two Aramaic, Israeli, and that's news to me.
Yes.
So what's the difference between the two languages?
I don't know Israeli Aramaic. I just know it's... I know a little bit to read the Babylonian
Rashi,
man.
For example, is
Rashi?
Yes.
No, Rashi's French. Rashi's French. Rashi spoke French.
No, Aramaic.
No, Rashi's French.
Really?
Rashi's French. Rashi is not a lot of generations after the Gemara. You can see it here in the Rishonim. That's our last meeting in 3 weeks from now. Rashi lived 300 years after the Babylonian Talmud has finished his edit, and he gave his commentaries about that. Yes?
I was under the impression that when there was a conflict between the Amorite Israel and Babylon, that they went according to the Israeli.
Yes, you know why? Because Israel is much more ancient. The Israeli Babylon was finished, the editing of it was finished around 300 years before the Babylonian one was finished. They have like 200 years that was overlapping, and afterwards, only the Babylonian one continued. And the Yerushalmi one was not written in Yerushalayim. You know where it was written? In Tveria, in Tiberias. Not in Yerushalayim. So why is it called the Yerushalmi? For giving honor and dignity and to honor Yerushalayim as the capital of Israel. But it was not in Yerushalayim. It was up in the north. Most of the Amoraim, of the rabbis, in the Talmudic time in Israel, they live up north in Galilee, in this area. That's another discussion, why in the north, what happened to Jerusalem and everything, but they lived up north. So the Talmud itself was in Tiberias, which was the biggest city back then with Torah and schools. Please open your source sheets. It's not a source sheet, it's a computer. I wanna learn a little bit, how does a Talmud page look like? What is a Talmud page? There is no other book in the world that looks like this. No other book. Open your first page, this, the squares here, the colorful one. First of all, let's go one step to another. You can all the time, you can flip the page to another one so you can see a real Talmud page, and both of them have color so you can see exactly what color we're talking about. So let's start with a header. First of all, there's the number of the page. Page in Gemara means daf. Daf divided to two. Two amudim. How would you say amud?
Columns?
It's not a column. I mean, there is a page. Page is a daf. Let's say
side.
Side is good. Side is good. Let's say side. Daf in Hebrew is not a page. Daf in Hebrew is paper. All right? It's not a page. Page is amud. But we say page in English, but it's a paper. So when I say, please open daf bet amud, bet, please open page number two, side number two. That means I'm going to page number two. Those two sides are one page. The first side is side number A. The second side is side number B. But they are both page two. It's not like in our modern books where we have 11, 12, 13, 14, all right? It's not like that.
It's double-sided.
It's double-sided. There's one, there's side A, and there's side B. So when I say, please open Talmud, page, dafchet, amud bet. That means you need to go, and there's no numbers. You need to go through the Hebrew aleph bet. You need to go to page number 8 and to the first side of it. That's how the page works in the Gemara. Next to it, you have the sedarim. What is the sedarim? Sedarim are orders and masachtot. Masachtot in English is terdicate. Please open the last page that you have. I made this map. It's a little bit tiny. I'm sorry for those that struggle to read it. But we know that the Mishnah, is divided into six different orders. Sedarim. Zeraim, which is seeds, and discusses prayers.
Like sections?
Like sections, exactly. Six different volumes, sections. First volume is Zeraim. Zeraim is seeds. Discussing prayers, times in the day, blessings, all of this. Second one is Moed, Seder Moed. Moed is festivals, discussing all the festivals. Shabbos, Pesach, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, everything that we have. Not only that, it discusses fasts. Discusses going up in the regalim to Jerusalem. The third one is Nashim, women. Discussing all the halachot regarding women, marriage, everything that has to be there. That is the third one. Fourth one is Nezakim, damages. This is the most fascinating one. This is my favorite. Nezakim, and the most challenging one, some say. Nezakim damages. Nezakim is just like, think like you're opening a course in civil law. What happens between neighbors? One neighbor wants to build a wall, a fence, between the other yard and the other one doesn't want to do so. The halacha has something to say about it. What happens if I find a lost in the street? I found money. Can I just take it? Is it mine? What happens with it? Do I need to look for the owner? What can I do then? What happens if, I don't know, I damaged someone's house? If I got into, God forbid, a car accident, who needs to pay for whatever happened? All these questions are halachic questions. Halacha has a lot to say about those discussions. All this and more is discussed in Seder Nezikin. Again, we're talking about the Mishnah. All those halachot are in the Mishnah. The section of Nezakim, damages. And in Seder Nezakim, we have Masechet Avot. Masechet Avot, our father's Masechet, is not about Nezakim. It's a different discussion what it has to do with damages, but it's the ethics, the moral. We saw last time Moshe kibel Torah Mishinai. Moses, God, received the Torah on Mount Sinai. U'masra liYehoshua, v'Yehoshua lizkenim. This is from Masechet Avot. Afterwards, we have Kodashim, holy things. Kodashim, Some might say this is the most difficult one. Kodashim is, let's discuss the holies. What happens in the temple? How do you sacrifice stuff? What are the halachot of sacrifices? How do you work in the temple? What do you do every day in the temple? Who works in what? All of this and more is in Kodashim. And the last one, the sixth one, is Tohorot. Purities. Let's talk about impurity. Purity. Mikveh. What is Tameh? What is Tahor? How do you define those stuff? What happens for a Kohen? Can a Kohen come into a Bet Kvarot, into a graveyard? Can't he? Why? Can't he marry someone? Can he not marry? All of this discussion about impurity is in the sixth one. This division to six volumes is artificial. This division is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's division. He decided to separate all those halachot, all those mishnayot, into six different columns. Again, until him, all of this was oral. It was not written down. He decided to make it an order, to divide everything into... Why did he decide to put, let's say, Nazir? Nazir is... it's not a monk. Nazir is Nazir. I don't like to translate Nazir as a monk. It's a Jewish monk. Let's say a Jewish monk. Why is it in Hashim? Why is it in woman? What happened? Why is it in woman? What does a monk, a Jewish monk, laws has to do in with woman? So...
Might be.
But this is what Rabbi Yehuda Anasi decided to do. So the Gemara will ask, wait, when it discusses the laws of Nazir, of a Jewish monk, she will ask, why is it in Nashim? That's a question that the generations after Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, they ask. And they give an answer there. They say, oh, why it is here? Because the last tedekate is Sota. Sota is another tedekate in Seder Nashim that discusses what happens if a woman or a man... betray each other, that's the word? Betray? I think it's betray the word? Yeah. Kind of. What happened then? So there's another halachot about what can they divorce? What did she do? Did she go to the Kohen Gadol? Did she go to the Bet HaMikdash, to the temple? Did she bring a sacrifice? A lot of halachot regarding loyalty between married couple. And the Gemara says that if someone sees a woman betraying her husband, he needs to become a Nazir, a monk, a Jewish monk. That's why the Gemara says, the whole discussion why. But this is an example of a discussion that the Gemara says and a conclusion that the Gemara gets in order to understand why a question that she writes on the Mishnah. You can see the entire Masachtot in the colorful table that you have here. So Zeraim has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 Masachtot, terdekates. Masachtot are Gemara. When I say Masechet, excuse me. When I say Masechet, I mean Mishnah. Masechet is every volume, every section divided into small books in it. Different chapters, different books, different subjects. I have here Moed. This is Mishnayot section Moed, Moed festivals. So we have here Yoma. Yoma is the first one. Yoma is Yom Kippur. Let's discuss Halachot of Yom Kippur, for example. First Halacha in Yom Kippur is... Shivat yamim kodem yom kippurim afreshin kohen gadol mibeitol lishkat paletrin. 7 days before Yom Kippur, you should take the Kohen Gadol from his house to the office of Palhedrin. First law. What is it? All right, maybe back then Rabbi Yehuda Anasi understood what he wrote. But no one understood afterwards. What does it say? So the Gemara, when she will explain this specific Yoma and she will ask about this Mishnah, this Halacha, she will ask, what is lishkat Palhedrin? What is it? She doesn't know what it means. They didn't live back then. They don't understand what that means. They need to figure out. So people will say, oh, I remember. I learned from my mother, from my grandmother, that Lishkat Paledrin is something like that. No. I saw, there's a lot of discussions. What is it? A lot of opinions on one thing, one line from the Mishnah. The other thing is Sukkah. The laws of Sukkot. How can you build a Sukkah? What is a kosher Sukkah? What is not a kosher Sukkah? What is the size of a Sukkah? Can it be round? Can a Sukkah be round? Can you build a round Sukkah? Can a Sukkah be like a pyramid? Does it need to be flat? What material do you need in order to build a Sukkah? Third one is Beitza. What is Beitza?
An egg.
What is eggs? What is Masechet egg? What is it? No, really, what do you think? What is Masechet egg?
Fertility.
Interesting, no. Interesting. Any other options? What is Masechet egg? Terdicate eggs. What is it? Cooking, interesting. Beitza shenolda beyom tov. You heard of it? What happened I won't forget that in the movie, the original movie, Fiddler on the Roof, when Chaim Topol plays the Tuvia, when he sings, right? If I Were a Rich Man, yeah. Da, la, li, la, li, la, and he sits down at the last line that he sits and says, I could be, if I were a rich man, I would sit down next to the rabbi, and I will learn, what? I will learn about Beitza Shenolda Beyom Tov. What happens if an egg was not gave birth, but what's the verb of an egg that laid? Thank you. What happened if an egg was laid during Yom Tov? Can you use it? Can you not use it?
No.
What do you do with it? No.
You cannot
use it. Interesting. Bet Shammai omrim teachel. The class of Bet Shammai say, you know what? An egg that was born in Yom Tov, that was laid, excuse me, teachel can be eaten. Bet Hillel omrim lo teachel. Jews.
I was right.
What now? What do you do now? Let's open the Gemara. We'll see what the Gemara has to say. Wait. Why did Bet Hillel say no? Why did Bet Shammai say no? So we have a law that Gemara says every time there is a machloka, there is a dispute between Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai, halacha is like Bet Hillel. Thank you. Right, there's exceptions. Right, exceptions. All right, but this is Talmud. The Talmud needs to figure out what can I do now with those two options, because Rabbi Yehuda wrote all of them. He understands what he's supposed to do, but we don't understand what he's supposed to do. So those are discussions. So the Gemara doesn't just say, "Oh, open page number 7, law number 8." The answer is Bet Hillel. No, it's not like that. It's discussion. One say Bet Hillel said it because they think it's like that. The other rabbi will say, "Really? But I have a question for you. Why do you say that Bet Hillel said because of that? But I remember, and I know, there's another source, another Mishnah, all the way to Taharot, another book. Let's say this is the Mishnah. They knew the Mishnah. Very good. There is another Mishnah, all the way to Taharot. And there is a Mishnah where Bet Hillel say a thing that if the way you understood Bet Hillel is correct, then they contradict each other. We cannot understand Bet Hillel like that. This is a classic discussion, the Gemara. Someone says his opinion, someone raises a question, he doubts his opinion, he needs to answer. He raises another question, he needs to answer again. Another question, he answers again until, and then he raises a question to the other person and he answers again. Those kinds of dialogues, of discussions, are throughout the entire Gemara. The Gemara is based, informed of discussions. That's what there is. This way is very, it's not so easy to learn Gemara. Why it's not so easy to learn Gemara? First of all, because of the language. It's not so easy to learn Aramaic. We don't speak Aramaic. We don't. You need to practice like any language. It's like Chinese. You saw the flyer, the poster. I changed the Aramaic to Chinese because for some people, and for me, still, the Gemara is like Chinese for sometimes. You need a translation. So Baruch Hashem, today we're in a generation where there are a lot of commentaries, and we can understand a little bit more. We can see... Why it was not written in Hebrew? Because they did not speak Hebrew back then.
The Torah is written in Hebrew.
Oh. Because the Torah, the only person in history who came back to Hebrew and say, you know what, we should speak Hebrew as a speaking language and not as an everyday language is? Eliezer ben Yehuda. If it's not for Eliezer ben Yehuda, we would speak or Yiddish or Ladino if we were Sephardic or Aramaic if we lived back then or French if we were French or... Hebrew was never the everyday language. Only back then during Bait Sheni, during the Second Temple, they spoke Hebrew. But since then, all the way to Eliezer ben Yehuda, in the beginning of the 20th century, they didn't speak Hebrew. They did not speak Hebrew as an everyday language. That's why the Gemara is not written in Hebrew. Please, I don't have a lot of time, and I want to continue about going through how the page of the Gemara looks like. So we have the Siddurim, the order. Order can be Masechet Beitza. Order can be, let's say, Nashim, and then Masechet Beitza. Then we have, look at the heading, all right? The heading is the first word. Every time the first word of the Gemara would be like illustrated, very nice. You can see the name Matai in a rectangle with flowers, and then there is the Mishnah. The Gemara quotes the Mishnah all the time. You can even understand when the Mishnah starts and when the Mishnah ends, because they have four letters that say this is the Mishnah. Mem, Taf, Nun, Yud. Matni. Matni is a shortcut of Matnitin. Matnitin in Aramaic is Mishnah. Sometimes in Aramaic and Hebrew they switch between the Taf and the Shin. Mashni, Mishnah, it's all the same. Matni, Mashni. You shone, you learn, you repeat. So Matni is the head of the Mishnah. And then it quotes the Mishnah. For example, I'm in Masechet Chagiga. Now, this is in Moed. The first Mishnah in Masechet Chagiga is Hakol Chayavin Bereya Chutz Michheresh Otev Katan. Everything must, everywhere, everyone must go to Jerusalem in the three holidays of Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot to see the temple. We have this mitzvah of going to the regal, going to Jerusalem in those three holidays, except of Cheresh, a deaf person, Shote, someone who is crazy, and Katan, and someone who is before Bar Mitzvah or Bat Mitzvah. First Mishnah. It quotes the Mishnah. It's in Hebrew. And then, when it says Gimel Mem, which is a shortcut for Gemara, then the Gemara starts. And the Gemara, how do you know that it's a Gemara, not a Mishnah? First of all, because it's going to say Gimel Mem. Second of all, it's going to turn into Aramaic. The Mishnah is in Hebrew. The Gemara is in Aramaic. And then you can learn about the Mishnah, about the Gemara, what the Gemara has to say, what are the discussions. It's all, the Gemara is only the orange part of it, alright? Everything else is not Gemara. I know, it's weird, but the Gemara is only the orange part of the book, of the page. Not all the time it's so small. Sometimes it's bigger, alright? You can see in the other page here. You can see that orange here, then it's a little bit bigger. But yeah, a lot of times there is no Mishnah. Sometimes the discussions are so long that it spreads to other pages. It continues. So there's no Mishnah yet in other pages because the discussion continues. Another thing that you will notice that there is no in the Gemara, and it makes it very difficult, there is no punctuation. It's not punctuated. There is no comma, there is no periods, there is no question mark, no exclamation mark, nothing. Nothing. Try to figure out, break your teeth, try to figure out why it writes it like that. Try to understand it a little bit. Where exactly does the sentence end? Here. Here, where do you put the dot? Before that word, after the word. Sometimes it's like life or death.
More to argue about.
More to argue about, exactly. More to, where do you put the sometimes they discuss, you know, the generation after, I'll give you in a minute, the generation after the Gemara discusses, wait, where do you put the dot? Because you can understand different halacha totally if you put the dot right here or right here. But they don't, it's not punctuated. How can you learn it if it's not punctuated? That's why it's difficult. But today we have translations and we have punctuation. And we have commentaries. And it's much more accessible to get into this really wise text. Look at the other stuff that we have here in the Truat Hadaf. This is the Mishnah and the Gemara. This is the most important stuff. It's the Mishnah and Gemara. If you know that, you can open the Daf of Gemara. What is the rest? The rest is called Nos'ei Kelim. Nos'ei Kelim, in Hebrew, that's a term for commentaries. Different commentaries that were added to the Gemara years, hundreds of years after the Gemara was finished. If you see written manuscripts of the Gemara, of the Talmud, there is nothing surrounding it. It's only a huge block of text. Nothing else. The edition, the printed edition, understood that, you know, in generation, after the generation after the Gemara, when it started to be printed, they understood that it's really, really difficult. And you need to add commentaries on the page itself in order to understand it, to be able to read it and to learn it. Yes?
Maybe I'll ask it at the end, but...
Oh, right. Sorry. You're right. Thank you.
So the question is...
Sorry.
We know, like, soon after the time we started following Hillel.
Mm-hmm.
So why does the Gemara Bavli, why do they still focus on... Hillel and Shammai, if it was already considered that we only follow Hillel, like why continue the discussion of the Machlokas?
Who said you need to follow Hillel?
Well, I thought that was a tradition to follow
Hillel. Yeah, so you need to understand. So the Gemara will tell you that you need to understand that you go from Hillel.
Oh, okay.
All right? You need to understand that. So one of the rules that the Gemara will say, oh, you know what? Follow Hillel all the time. Yes?
I asked a rabbi once, or more than once, if you read Torah in English, how much are you missing from it? As a corollary to that, if you read Torah or study Torah only, but not Mishnah and not Gemara, how deficient is your knowledge of overall Judaism?
That's an amazing question. Translation all the time will be commentary as well. You cannot translate something without giving your own interpretation into it. Never. When you learn Rashi on the Torah, you learn the Torah in the eyes of Rashi. You don't learn the Torah in the eyes of the Torah all the time. When you translate the Torah into English, you learn the Torah. No, there are words and you need to decide how to translate it. How do you know which word to choose? That's interpretation. I will discuss more than that after this year, all right? Because we don't have a lot of time, and if that's fine with you, I do want to finish one thing left that I have. So all of this is commentary. The basic, most popular parshan, interpreter on the Talmud is Rashi. Rashi is everywhere on the Torah, right? And we know it from the Torah, and we know it from the Gemara, from the Talmud. He will be mostly, that's a little bit tricky. So, if you open the first side, the side number A of the page, Rashi would be on the left side of it. On the right side, excuse me. If you open side number A of the Talmud, Rashi would be on the right side of it. If you turn the page into side number B, all the page is like a mirror. It's like a reflection of the other page. Rashi would appear now on the left one. All right? Another thing too for us, the difficulty in learning Gemara, that was how it was printed. That how it's printed since 1600 all the way till today, in modern printers, that's how they do it. All right. So Rashi's commentary. You can read a little bit the biography of it. On the other side, we have what is called the Tosfot. Tosfot are different Rishonim. It's not one person. There are different Rishonim in the age of Rashi, in Rashi's period and afterwards, like 200 years of different rabbis that wrote commentaries and questions on the Gemara itself. That's the first time where someone took the Gemara. Not the first time, but that's the most important time where someone took the Gemara and asked questions on the Gemara itself. Why did the Gemara say that? But the Gemara contradicts itself in another place. What the Gemara did to the Mishnah, the Tosfot are doing to the Gemara. We're Jews. That's how we do. We all the time, we ask questions on our past generation, all the time. And they ask the question on the Gemara itself. You can learn Gemara without Rashi and Tosfot. You can do it. But sometimes you have questions, and you would not understand maybe a word in Aramaic that you don't know what the translation is. So you go to Rashi, and he will tell you. Sometimes you have a question. Wait, but I learned another. I'm now already into Gemara, and I saw that the Gemara said in another place something totally different. You'll go to Tosfot, and you see what his answer is for this question. But remember, Rashi did not have Rashi. When Rashi wrote his commentary, he did not have Rashi. He did not have...
He had the Midrash, though.
He had the Midrash, exactly. But still, when Rashi wrote what he wrote, he did not have anything for us. All the new commentaries after Rashi have Rashi. They can use Rashi in order to understand the Gemara. Rashi understood the Gemara by his own. That's high. That's like the highest level of wisdom one can... You know, once, and we'll finish with that once... there was a news report in Israel on the news that a delegation from Singapore, they came to Israel. Why? Why did they come to Israel? Why did they have to look in Israel? They say, you know why we're coming to Israel? And they went to a yeshivot in Bnei Brak and in Jerusalem, and like you saw all the Singapores are coming, and like it was their suit, and they're coming into Hebron and Panovich, all those yeshivot, the yeshivot of the Haredi yeshivot in Bnei Brak and in Jerusalem. And people asked him, what are you doing here? They told them, it's a real story. They told them, you know why we're here? Because we think that the high percentage of Jews that won the Nobel Prize, you know why? It's because of the Talmud. We want to be smart like the Jewish people, and we think that the Gemara, learning Talmud for thousands of years, is what made the Jewish people so spicy, so edgy in the way they think, and internalized, and we want to teach Talmud in our schools. And today in Singapore, some of the schools teach Talmud. There is a Talmud translated into, I think it's Chinese or whatever it is. There is. And they learn Talmud. And they're not Jews at all. But they learn Talmud because they want to be smarter. Because when you learn discussions of someone, it's not Korea, I know from Singapore. Maybe they're Koreans as well. I don't know. Maybe they're Koreans as well. I know from Singapore. And when you learn discussion, why is it so difficult? But why is it so, you know, it's like practice, like training to your brain. Why? Because when you open a page of Talmud and you read the discussion and you read different opinions and you need to understand why someone says another, what is exactly the claim that someone has upon another one's opinion, and you need to get into the essence of why did he really understand why someone said what he said, and how can you prove that what he said is wrong? It's really difficult. You need to get into really the depth of someone's opinion and to understand something and to try to prove your point. And some studies say that this is really, really like a brain practice to the brain. Thank you so much. I just want to tell you that you have in your source sheet. Please take it with you. That's all for you. The last page is, you can see, you can turn it to the last one. The last page is Rashi font. We didn't have time to get to it, but this is for you for homework. Rashi script. Rashi had his own handwriting, his own script. Correct or not? Correct or wrong?
Yeah.
Wrong.
No.
Ktav Rashi. Rashi's script is not Rashi's. Rashi did not write in Rashi's script.
It's a publisher.
Exactly. Rashi's script is a publisher. 100 years after Rashi, who wanted to add the Rashi into the Gemara and did not have enough space and room to write the Hebrew letters in the pages that he had then. So he tried to shorten a little bit the letters and to write them in a little bit different way, in a different font, in order so they can fit in the page. That's Rashi. Since then, everyone thinks this is a Rashi's handwriting. No, Rashi did not write in this handwriting. He wrote in Hebrew. All right? So, this is a vocabulary, a dictionary for how is the letter in Hebrew looks like and what is the letter in the Rashi script. You can see at the bottom there are examples for you to try to read. That's like a Ktav Starim, like a mystery code for you to for homework. It's good for you. You don't have to know how to read a Rashi script. It's a good skill. It's a good skill to understand not only the Gemara, but afterwards a lot of books that was written were published with Rashi script. I don't know why. It's not so important, but a lot of this happened. And another thing that you have here is another explanation of the page. You can see it. Looks like that. That's another explanation of how the page looks like, just more with more explanation. That's what I said. It's just written down. You can see it. Every part of the page has its own biography and description on the page itself. We finished. Thank you so much. Really. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to have a little practical practice. I'm going to give you, you're going to learn by your own. I'm going to give you, I'm going to print you a sugya, like a discussion for the Gemara. We'll try to understand a little bit, to see a little bit what the Amoraim said, how the Gemara talks about, what is the syntax, the grammar of the Gemara itself. And Bezrat Hashem, I hope that after this series, we will all be able to open the daf and a little bit to try to understand what's the essence of this amazing, most influential book. Yes, in Jewish history. Thank you. Thank you all. I'm here for questions, whoever wants to ask. Thank you.